The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And thanks so much for joining me today. Today we'll be reading from The Week magazine, dated May 18th, 2012. Our first article is from the main story section of the week, and it's entitled, European Voters Say No to Austerity. What happened? Voters in France and Greece delivered a resounding rejection of austerity measures this past week, ousting political leaders who had advocated painful budget cuts and tax hikes as the best way to counter Europe's debt crisis. In France, François Hollande secured a narrow 51-49% victory over President Nicolas Sarkozy, the first time in 17 years that a Socialist Party candidate has won the Élysée Palace. Together with German Chancellor Angela Merkel, Sarkozy was a key architect of Europe's attempt to restore confidence in the euro currency through strict fiscal discipline. But Hollande argued that growth would be best achieved through stimulus spending, contending that the singular emphasis on budget cuts had burdened the continent with recessions and soaring unemployment. "Austerity no longer needs to be our fate," he said. In debt-ridden Greece, furious voters punished mainstream parties that backed the tough terms of the country's eurozone, imposed bailout, handling extreme left and right-wing parties opposed to austerity more than 60% of the vote, with no single party securing enough seats in the parliament to form a viable coalition. The troubled country was expected to return to the polls in 2 weeks. In Berlin, Merkel said the French and Greek votes would not alter her insistence. Recently ratified by the European Union, that deeply indebted nations engage in belt tightening. The fiscal pact is not negotiable, she said. It has been negotiated and signed by 25 countries. Now here's what the editorials had to say. The French and Greeks are living in a dream world, said the Daily Telegraph in the UK. They've tricked themselves into believing that in place of self-sacrifice, there may be some magical, pain-free way out of this crisis. Hollande has promised he'll balance the budget by 2017. By going for growth, what he actually means is that he will have to borrow more. That could be catastrophic in a country where debt is forecast to hit a record 90% of GDP next year. But relentless austerity is not working, said the New York Times. In Greece and Spain, vicious cuts to government spending have sent unemployment soaring to almost 25%, and their economies plunging into a crippling recession. Hollande grasps a simple truth that has eluded Merkel, that while many troubled European nations need to wrestle their budgets under control, they cannot repay their debts unless they are also allowed to grow. And now here's what the columnist said. French and Greek voters are protesting an austerity that exists only on paper, said James Petakoukas in the New York Post. A new study by George Mason University found that France and Greece haven't significantly reduced spending since austerity supposedly started in 2008. That's bad news, as research shows that debt levels above 90% of GDP, America's currently at just over 100%, can lower economic growth for a generation. Americans should view Europe as a warning not about the dangers of cutting government spending, but about what happens when big government runs out of other people's money. But the French election wasn't mainly about austerity, said Christopher Dickey in the DailyBeast.com. Sarkozy lost simply because he was Sarkozy. The French disliked his vulgar ways, the $70,000 watch, the partying on millionaires' yachts, the ex-supermodel wife, and his belligerent, argumentative style. bland bureaucrat Holland won largely because of who he wasn't. Sarkozy's departure may mean trouble for all of Europe, said Max Fischer in TheAtlantic.com. He and Merkel created a Franco-German partnership that set the new EU agenda of fiscal restraint, an agenda Holland has explicitly rejected. Germany doesn't decide for all of Europe, he recently sniffed. If Europe's two main powers can't get along, then the whole project of European unity could start to falter. Holland might want to lead the battle in Europe against austerity, said Gideon Rockman in the Financial Times, but Greece makes that impossible. Greece's economic crisis is so severe that without deep cutbacks, it will go bankrupt and be booted out of the euro. Faced with a choice between supporting Greece and supporting Germany, the French will stick with their grumpy but solvent ally just next door. Our next article from the main story section this week is entitled Obama Evolves on Gay Marriage. President Obama declared his personal support for gay marriage for the first time this past week after he came under mounting pressure to take a stand. The president, who had previously described his views on same-sex marriage as evolving, told ABC News, "For me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married." Obama said, however, that he still believes states should decide the issue on their own. Earlier in the week, Vice President Joe Biden told an interviewer he was absolutely comfortable with gay marriage, bringing a new wave of criticism on the president for lacking political courage. Mitt Romney, the president's GOP rival, reaffirmed his own opposition to gay marriage. "I do not favor marriage between people of the same gender," he said, "and I do not favor civil unions if they are identical to marriage other than by name." Obama's decision to endorse gay marriage brings real political risk, said Chris Saliza in WashingtonPost.com. On the plus side, it will fire up Obama's young liberal fans and could even excite the donor base, given that one in six of Obama's campaign bundlers is gay. But gay marriage is still a hot-button issue in a nation that narrowly supports it, and it could hurt him in some swing states in November. In the end, Obama had little choice but to get off the fence, given the furor caused by Biden. The president needn't worry too much, said Jennifer Rubin, also in the WashingtonPost.com. This long-awaited final stage of his cynical evolution probably won't change a single vote. Most opponents of gay marriage are committed conservatives who would never vote for Obama, and black Democrats who generally oppose gay marriage will support him no matter what. The most likely result is a sudden surge in enthusiasm for Romney among evangelicals and social conservatives. Soon enough, everyone will go back to worrying about the economy. Political implications aside, this is a hugely important historic turning point for gay people, said Frank Bruni in NYTimes.com. For our highest elected official to openly support the right of gays and lesbians to marry shows he thinks of them as equals, our humanity as unassailable, as any other Americans. Every closeted teen cowering in fear that their sexuality marks them out as different or wrong can take assurance, reassurance, from that. Our country has traveled an enormous distance. The next article from the main story section, a lackluster jobs report. Job growth slowed for a second straight month in April, adding to fears that the U.S. economy is stalling again after promising signs of an expansion earlier in the year. Employers created just 115,000 jobs in April, according to the Labor Department, far fewer than the monthly average of 252,000 added from December through February. The unemployment rate ticked down slightly from 8.2 to 8.1%, the lowest rate since January 2009, but that was a result of more than 340,000 people leaving the labor force. The mediocre report dilutes President Obama's message that the economy is on the mend. Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney seized on the numbers as evidence that the economy is slowing down, not speeding up. "However you slice it, it's not a pretty picture," said the New York Post in an editorial. The strong jobs figures earlier in this year now look like the result of the unseasonably warm weather rather than any economic recovery. And the percentage of Americans in the labor force is now the lowest in more than three decades. It's long past the point where the president can blame this desperate state of affairs on his predecessor. Actually, this perfect Rorschach test of a report lets both Democrats and Republicans see whatever they want to see, said Zachary Carabel in the DailyBeast.com. Those looking for a positive spin can point to the fact that the economy is still adding jobs. Pessimists can cite stagnant wages and the chronic problem of long-term unemployment. In a sense, they're both right, since these figures show the jobs picture getting neither better nor worse. At least the economy is still growing, said Greg Ipp in Economist.com. Earlier job numbers continue to be revised upward, and other data like strong car sales, upticks in factory purchasing, and the stock market climb show no signs of a sudden drop-off. That isn't enough to ensure Obama's re-election, but it's enough to suggest that a stall isn't upon us. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week. Football. Is So's death a tipping point? Junior So didn't just kill himself last week, said Joel Mathis in PhillyMag.com. He probably killed football itself. The NFL legend and future Hall of Famer was found dead at his California home with a gunshot wound, tellingly, to his chest. Though the 43-year-old former linebacker left no suicide note, the speculation is that, like former Chicago Bear Dave Duerson last year, So avoided shooting himself in the head so that doctors could study the damage done to his brain by 20 years of high-speed collisions in the NFL. Duerson's brain was found to be ravaged by chronic traumatic encephalopathy, a condition brought on by multiple concussions that causes depression and early-onset dementia. Autopsies on a host of other players who committed suicide or died prematurely in recent years have also revealed CTE, with doctors saying that one player, 44-year-old Andre Waters, had the brain of an 85-year-old suffering from Alzheimer's. How does anyone with a conscience continue to watch a sport that turns men's minds into mush? The suicide of the charismatic, widely liked So may be a tipping point, said Barbara Bruno in HuffingtonPost.com. Fans have been in denial, but it's now obvious that everyone who watches the game is complicit in these tragedies. I love the game dearly, said Ta-Nehisi Coates in the Atlantic.com, but I'm out. While players are consenting adults who have a right to do whatever they want with their bodies on a Sunday afternoon, I refuse to participate in their self-destruction. Even the players are starting to rebel, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. More than 1,500 former players are suing the NFL in dozens of lawsuits for allegedly concealing the impact of repeated concussions on their brains. When both medical science and the courts assess the full human cost of America's favorite spectator sport, football, just like boxing before it, could soon end up in a sport whose best days are past. I'd hate to see that happen, said Andy Staples in SportsIllustrated.com. Football is a wonderful game, not only for spectators, but for amateur players who learn so much about life by testing themselves in the crucible between the end zones. To save the game, the NFL and college football, too, has to do whatever it takes to make the sport safer. Yes, it will require something drastic, perhaps outlawing the helmets that embolden players to use their heads as weapons. But football is too great a sport to continue under this cloud. But how do you take the violence out of football, said Buzz Bissinger in the DailyBeast.com. The game is primal and vicious and visceral, a form of warfare staged on grass. One reason tens of millions of us watch the college game and the NFL is the vicarious thrill we get when one player flattens another with a hit that knocks the snot out of his nose. When autumn rolls around and we're asked, "Are you ready for some football?" we'll say, "Sure am," even if we feel slightly guilty about it. The fans may not turn off the game right away, said John Cass in the Chicago Tribune, just as it took decades for boxing to wither. But as tragedies like Junior Seau's continue to mount, parents will decide that it's not worth the risks to let their sons play at any level, from Pop Warner to college. When there aren't enough young players to replenish the ranks, we may see the beginning of the end of the world's most violent, glamorous sport. And now from the main story section of the Week magazine, we'll turn to the popular column, A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for standing your ground after a Japanese woman chased a mugger who stole her bag, took it back, and bit off his finger. Police said the finger had been found at the crime scene, but declined to say whether a fingerprint had been taken to identify the assailant. It was a good week for adult education after Alan Stewart of Australia received his fourth college degree, a master's in clinical science, at the age of 97. Stewart said he'd finally completed his education, but added, "I said that after my last degree, and then I got bored." It was a good week for surrendering to tyranny. After former Republican presidential candidate Representative Michelle Bachmann capitalized on her husband's heritage to become a dual U.S. and Swiss citizen. Switzerland, a nation in Europe, has universal health care and an individual mandate. It was a bad week for fake IDs after University of Iowa student Stephen Fiorella, 19, was charged with trying to get into a bar using a stolen driver's license. The license belonged to the bouncer who was working at the door. It was a bad week for President Obama's chances of taking West Virginia after prison inmate Keith Russell Judd won 40% of the vote in a Democratic primary there against Obama's 60%. "I voted against Obama," explained one of Judd's supporters. And it was a bad week for Republicans who like Cher. After the singer tweeted, "If Romney gets elected, I don't know if I can breathe same air as him and his right-wing, racist, homophobic, women-hating teabagger masters." She later tweeted an apology for being a hater, saying, "Sorry, I let the dogs out." Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the People section. Our first article is entitled, Bolt's Relaxed Pace. "Usain Bolt is not like other mortals," said Mark Bailey in the Daily Telegraph in the UK. "In fact, he's not even like other champion sprinters. With his long legs, he takes 41 steps to complete the 100 meters. His rivals take 44. He also has an unusually high percentage of fast-twitch muscle fibers, which produce explosive speed. Because my running style looks effortless, a lot of people think I'm lazy," says the Jamaican track star. "I say to them, see you in the morning at 6 a.m., come and watch me train." Off the track, Bolt takes life at a far more leisurely pace. He surrounds himself with old friends, and when he's not training, he hangs out with them at his Kingston mansion. "He hates doing chores. Once a year, I will clean my room just because I feel I should," he says. Not surprisingly, he loses things. He left his Olympic gold medals in a New York hotel room, but later recovered them, and found his world championship medals in his closet after a year of searching. Bolt has hired a chef to keep him on the culinary straight and narrow and away from his favorite junk food. "My coach informs him what to cook, and it's not KFC," he says glumly. "He does what he is told, and so do I." The next article is entitled, The Troop's Favorite Bootlegger. Hyman Strachman is America's most patriotic DVD pirate, says Alan Schwartz in the New York Times. Over the past 8 years, the 92-year-old has sent some 300,000 illegally copied movies to troops in Iraq and Afghanistan at a personal cost of around $30,000. "It's not the right thing to do, but I did it," says the former stockbroker and World War II veteran. "If I were younger, maybe I'd be spending time in the hoosegow." Strachman, or Big High as he's known to GIs, started burning discs in 2003 after the death of his wife, Harriet. While looking for ways to keep busy, he discovered a website that collected soldiers' requests and noticed a recurring request for DVDs. Soon after he shipped a box of movies to an Army chaplain, "Chaplains don't sell them," he said, "and they fan out among the troops." The distribution is great. Strachman now spends up to 60 hours a week copying discs at his home in Massapequa, New York, and has been flooded with letters, photos, and American flags from grateful soldiers. "Every time I got back an emotional letter, I sent them another box." But with the war in Afghanistan in its final stages, he knows he'll soon have to find a new hobby. It's all over anyways. The troops are all coming home in the near future. And the next article from the People section is Cameron's Titanic Ambition. "James Cameron had a selfish reason for making Titanic," said Chris Heath in Men's Journal. The director had been obsessed with deep-sea exploration since elementary school, and as a child once built a miniature diving bell using a mayonnaise jar and an Erector set. He put his pet mouse in the contraption and lowered it into a nearby creek. "The mouse went to the bottom of the river, sat there for half an hour, and came back up," he remembers, still satisfied with his achievement. Cameron went on to have a hugely successful Hollywood career, directing blockbusters like The Terminator and True Lies, but he always wanted to return to the water and explore what he calls the ultimate shipwreck, the Titanic. There was just one problem. How would he find such a hugely expensive dive, or how would he fund such a hugely expensive dive? "I don't think the studio executives believe it, but I wanted to make Titanic because I wanted to dive the wreck. So the biggest grossing movie in motion picture history was the side effect of a personal whim?" "Exactly," he says, before reconsidering the question. "It's not a whim. A whim implies I think I'll go play pool tonight." "A quest, then. Quest," he agrees. "That's good." Now from the Week magazine, we'll turn to the section entitled Briefing, and this week the specific title of this article is The Return of Electroshock Therapy. One of psychiatry's most maligned treatments is experiencing a revival. Does electroshock therapy really work? Wasn't electroshock abandoned years ago? Well, not entirely, but its use did decline dramatically. Electroshock therapy began in the 1930s when Italian psychiatrists discovered that administering strong shocks to the brains of mentally ill patients sometimes relieved their symptoms. But by the 1970s, electroshock therapy became widely viewed as barbaric and ineffective, leaving its subjects vacant-minded shells of their former selves. That grossly simplistic view resulted partly from the egregious misuse of the technique. At the Georgia State Sanitarium in the 1940s, for example, a patient could be administered a Georgia Power cocktail just for being uncooperative. The use of electroshock as mind-erasing punishment was dramatized in the 1975 film One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And that negative portrayal almost served as a death knell for a practice derided as Edison's medicine. The use of electroshock fell from some 300,000 patients a year in the early 1960s to just 33,000 by 1980. But in recent years, the procedure has experienced a resurgence and is now used to treat about 100,000 patients a year. Why has it come back? Some psychiatrists have found that electroconvulsive therapy, as it is now called, is the last best hope for patients suffering from deep, unyielding depression. "It's a treatment that is life-saving for those people," said psychiatrist Max Fink, a leading defender of the practice. Today, ECT is usually administered in a hospital to patients under anesthesia, in conjunction with powerful muscle relaxants that suppress convulsions. An electric current pulses through the patient's brain for a few seconds, triggering a seizure that can last for up to a minute. After 6 to 12 sessions, advocates say ECT brings about a complete remission of symptoms in 75 to 85% of patients, though critics say the relief is only temporary. Well, how does it work? That is still something of a medical mystery. A recent study that used MRIs to study the brains of 9 patients and undergoing electroconvulsive therapy found that the seizures disrupt the normal patterns of blood flow and metabolism in the brain, dampening connections in the left side of the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, a region of the brain associated with negative thoughts, criticism, and anxiety. The same region in the right hemisphere appears to process uplifting, optimistic, and cheery ideas. Mental health and clear thinking require a balance of both, neuroscientists believe. ECT, the researchers speculate, might act to rebalance hemispheric activity. But is it safe? The medical establishment thinks so. James Scully, Jr., chief executive of the American Psychiatric Association, calls ECT extremely effective and safe, and maintains that advances have banished the risk of brain damage. Not everyone is convinced, however. It's a temporary blunting of your feelings, so you feel better for a while, then you feel worse. And now you've got the memory loss and brain damage, said psychologist John Breeding, an anti-ECT activist. Patients come down on both sides of the question of whether the side effects are worth braving. Electronics technician Bill Russell of Mill Creek, Washington, said he experienced months of debilitating short-term memory loss and confusion after his ECT treatments. But for him, that was a small price to pay for relief from the black depression that has plagued him since high school. When the fog started to clear, it was like waking up from a bad dream, he said. Well, what about the long-term effects? That is the subject of fierce debate. Psychiatrist Richard Abrams, founder of a company that makes an ECT device, said that not one of his patients over 3 decades ever reported prolonged memory loss, the side effect most associated with the procedure. But while ECT machines, and therefore the treatment, have been subject to U.S. Food and Drug Administration regulations since 1976, there have been no large long-term studies of patients. One federally financed 2007 study of 347 patients found worrisome instances of long-term memory loss and residual problems with thinking and learning. But the APA and many mental health specialists insist that decades of use have proved that electroshock is safe. Last year, they petitioned the FDA to remove ECT machines from their current high-risk status, making the treatment available to more patients. Will that happen? The FDA faces a difficult choice after the agency asked for comments from patients and doctors. Most physicians favored removing restrictions, but nearly 80% of the 3,045 comments from patients and their advocates ask for stricter oversight or even an outright ban on the treatment. Peter Bregan, a psychiatrist in Ithaca, New York, said the medical establishment sees electroshock as a way to make money off elderly depressed women on Medicare. But whether or not the FDA opens the door to more widespread use, said University of Iowa psychology professor Jane Paulson, electroconvulsive therapy will remain available for the most severe cases of depression. We're not going to be shutting down ECT, she said. And the footnote to this briefing column about electroshock therapy is entitled Saving Princess Leia. Carrie Fisher spiraled into the worst depression of her life after a close friend died in 2005. I was as close to being suicidal as you can be without being suicidal, said the 55-year-old actress, novelist, and Star Wars legend. I was devastated. When antidepressants and psychotherapy failed to help, she turned to ECT. Over time, this thing punched the dark lights out of my depression, she said. It was like a mute button muffling the noise of my shrieking feelings. Now she's come to depend on shock treatments every 6 weeks to keep her demons at bay, though she says the cure can be a bitch on memory. ECT's most common side effect, temporary memory loss, does have an upside, she said. She forgets movies she's just seen, but now I can be entertained by them all over again. Now from The Week magazine, we'll turn to the best columns in the U.S. according to The Week. Our first column is entitled, Bipartisanship Suffers Its Final Blow. And this was written by Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. Our country is headed for a major constitutional crisis, said Jonathan Chait, when Indiana Republicans defeated widely respected Senator Richard Lugar in a primary last week. It sent a clear signal that the bitter partisanship that's paralyzed Washington is about to get worse, not better. Lugar's opponent, the Tea Party-backed candidate Richard Murdoch, had assailed Lugar as a traitor for supporting the TARP bailout of the big banks and for voting to confirm President Obama's Supreme Court nominees, Elena Kagan and Sonia Sotomayor. Lugar was no fan of either, but he has believed in the long-standing Senate practice that Democratic presidents be allowed to pick qualified liberal justices, just as Republican presidents pick conservative ones. Now every Republican in Congress has been told that any cooperation with Democrats will cost them their jobs. Why would they ever vote for another Obama nominee? If the Democrats respond in kind, the courts will be filled with vacancies and all legislation will be killed by filibusters. Our democratic system is poorly equipped to handle unified, fanatical parties, and sadly, that's what the GOP has become. The next column is entitled The Necessity of Relying on Drones by Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Drone strikes are President Obama's tactic of choice in fighting terrorism, said Michael Gerson. Virtually every week, drones strike targets in North and South Waziristan and now Yemen. They've erased 2,200 al-Qaeda fighters in Pakistan and more than 200 in Yemen, according to independent estimates. Naturally, Obama has been heavily criticized for his use of drones by both the left and the right. Human rights activists call these assassinations extrajudicial murder. Conservatives brand the president a hypocrite for banishing the phrase war on terror, while clearly engaging in one. But the direct threats of violence against Americans from terrorist groups are real, leaving the president without the option of doing nothing. He could send troops to hunt terrorists in Yemen or Pakistan, but the death toll of that strategy, including of civilians, will be far higher. Predators and raptors may sometimes kill civilians, but they represent some of the most precise applications of force in the history of warfare, pinpointing individual enemies. And in the end, the commander-in-chief is responsible for protecting the U.S. from attack, which is exactly what he is doing. And the next column is entitled Raging Against the Machine by Stephen Moore in the Wall Street Journal. With 14 million Americans unemployed, said Stephen Moore, why has it become nearly impossible to call a store, business, or government agency and speak to a live human being? Call any airline or store or government agency and you find yourself being told by an irritating mechanical voice from an interactive voice response system to pick from lists of options. Soon you've lost in an endless corridor of choices that don't match why you called, while you futilely shout operator or agent. Companies install these systems to save money, but what they tell you, in effect, is our time is more valuable than yours, so keep pushing buttons. Not surprisingly, consumers are now rebelling, with websites springing up with tips on how to head fake the robotic gatekeepers. Some tips say operator right away and keep saying it. Don't play by their rules. If that doesn't work, curse a lot, because bad words can trigger a motion detector technology that will send you to a human operator. If you still can't get a live human being on the phone, do what I do. I now hang up and take my business elsewhere. And now, from the best columns of the week, we will move to the back of the magazine for The Last Word. This particular article this week is entitled, A Mother's Gifts. Moms Give Us Life and Guide Our Dreams. Four contributors to the radio series This, I Believe, describe how that happens. A Saving Love. As a child, I did not have the love of my biological mother. Everything in life seemed dark and indifferent to me. I allowed hatred and bitterness to dictate my actions. For 15 years, my life was a fight to survive, and I was a product of these dark emotions that tormented me daily. After 15 years of violence, abuse, and poor decisions, I surrendered my independence to the civil authorities who were in charge of keeping abused children. I met the mother who would show me a real mother's love in the county orphanage. She walked up to me and only asked if I wanted to leave the orphanage and live with her family. Although I could see love in her face and actions, my only thought at the moment was getting out of that place and isolating myself from others. After the hurt that I had experienced, I did not trust anyone. I had no concerns for the thoughts, feelings, or emotions of others. Later, I would discover that my new mother's decision to take me into her home was more than a physical act of compassion. She called it a spiritual duty. Her actions proved that claim, and my hardened exterior began to soften. She lived her life before me with power. On many occasions, I witnessed her prepare food for people who'd lost loved ones. She also prepared and took food to people who had no food. I have never forgotten these acts of kindness. Although her duties never seemed to cease, she relentlessly set before me an example of love that changed my life forever. My mother never acknowledged any difference between her daughters and me, her foster son. I can remember many evenings when she would come home tired from working as a registered nurse at the local hospital. She never failed to cook our supper or get us ready for school the next morning. When we were sick, she never abandoned us. She worked every day to make our lives better. I never witnessed such love and compassion in a person. The way she lived her life before me allowed me to turn away from the bitterness and grudges that made my world so dark. I know that many mothers have contributed to influencing their children in a positive manner, but my foster mother had a tougher task and precious little time to accomplish it. She had to strip away the darkness that 15 years of hatred had produced. She had to teach me how to love myself before I could love others. She accomplished her task, and my life today is a testimony to her devotion, faith, and character. I believe a mother's love has no boundaries. I know firsthand that it has the power to change lives. A mother's love can overcome hatred, animosity, and selfishness. It has the power to heal an abused heart and body. I can attest this to be true because it was a mother's hatred that made me bitter, but another mother's love that saved me from self-annihilation. And that wonderful article was written by Bruce Rankin. The second article is entitled, The Guardian. I believe my three-year-old son, who is not in the 95th percentile of anything, who did not know his alphabet by his first birthday, who is struggling mightily with shoes and the potty and most social graces, he is truly mournful when leaves fall off the trees in autumn, and he is as gentle and weird and kind as I dreamed my child would be. He does not know a second language yet, but he has a magical belly laugh. I believe if I could play a recording of it to warring nations, he would be heralded as an international peacekeeper. When I was a child in the 1970s, children were woefully unfashionable. Yet in retrospect, that decade may have been the last time children were allowed some breathing space. We didn't have to dwell so much on adult preoccupations of trends, fashion, and getting ahead. We could just be children. This is why I so fiercely guard my son's youth. I understand that the push for an achievement and the pressures we face as parents can be overwhelming, but I believe that I would be robbing my child of an essential gift if I didn't nurture and protect his youth. The world of playtime and the outdoors is the best laboratory available to my son. Last week we were at the playground when I heard a freckled girl in pull-ups call out to her mother from the top of the slide, asking for juice. "Ask me again in French," said her mother. The girl complied with an impatient eye roll. At that moment, all I could feel was worry for my child, who is still just getting his feet wet in English. But then I heard my son laughing. He was watching two squirrels chase each other up and down and around a maple tree. "Squirrels are silly," he said. Motherhood is a state of always being vulnerable to our expectations and worries about our children. I know that at his core, my son is a happy, free-spirited boy having the childhood he deserves. When I am at my best, I know that there is absolutely nothing to worry about, so at that moment, I forgot about his French-speaking peer and picked my son up, nuzzling those delicious satiny cheeks, and said, "Yes, squirrels are silly." And that was written by Marla Rose. The next article here is called "A Woman's Courage." My mother was a single parent in the war-torn country of Vietnam, struggling to raise two little girls and care for an aging mother. Hers was a typical story of a woman's dilemma in an impoverished land brought about by years of civil war. But she was different because she had the courage to make a decision that would change all our lives. Through various connections, she was able to get us passage on a small fishing boat. The plan was to get to the closest country that had diplomatic ties with the United States, where we would apply for political asylum. It was a dangerous plan, one that many had attempted and failed, and those who failed paid with their lives. My grandmother urged my mother to leave her kids behind. She explained that it was not wise to risk the lives of everyone in the family on the open sea. My mother, always stubborn, had made up her mind. She would not part from us. She vowed that in death as in life, we would remain together. My grandmother stayed behind. We tried three times to leave before we finally made it to international waters. While cruising in the open ocean, we encountered a pirate ship. By luck and the skill of our captain, we were able to outmaneuver our pursuer. We landed on Malaysia 3 days after we began the trip. We proceeded to poke holes in our vessel to prevent authorities from making us go back. We stayed in a refugee camp for a year, waiting for a philanthropic organization to sponsor our family in the United States. We were given permission to enter the country legally as political refugees. When we arrived in the United States, our first meal was pancakes and bacon. To this day, I still remember that first American meal with fondness. We relied on the kindness of strangers, people who agreed to accept the responsibility of helping us get adjusted to life in the United States. It has been almost 30 years since we made that journey. There's not been a day that passed when I do not think of the courage it took my mother to uproot her family and move us to a place so foreign that we didn't even know where it was or how to speak its language. It was her courage that enabled us to have a future better than what we dreamt of while growing up in Vietnam. How do you begin to thank someone who gave you not only life, but also a future? I hope that my mother knows it is her courage that I most admire and cherish. It is also a quality that I hope to have inherited from her. And that was written by Lien Pham. And the fourth and final article in this section is entitled, Call Your Mother. I started phoning my mother in college when distance suddenly necessitated that form of communications. Since then, we have been talking on the phone regularly, even though we now live in the same city. We've talked about life's big issues. Should I leave a long-term boyfriend and move to another town? Can I be a good mother and work full-time at a job that I also love? When she and my father separated, our roles reversed for a while as I listened to her questions and tried to help her articulate answers. But most of the time, we talk about the little things. What did you do today? How is work? Are the girls well? In over 25 years of phone calls, certain themes have emerged. Go outside and look at the moon, sweetie, she'll say over the phone at least a few times a year. I've never seen it brighter. I went to the reading terminal this morning the peaches are in. I'm so proud of you, and I love you. A few summers ago, some friends from college got together for a long weekend to celebrate our 40th birthdays. One of the women had been diagnosed with cancer that past winter. Carrie had finished her chemotherapy, her hair was growing back in, and the color was returning to her cheeks. Although she was a little more tired than the rest of us, she looked great. One afternoon, while she was napping, the house phone rang. I answered. Hello, a young girl's voice said. Is Carrie there, please? Hi, I replied. Is this her daughter? Yes, it is, she said quietly. She's resting now, but would you like to wake her? Would like me to wake her for you? I asked. I'm not sure, the girl responded in a small voice that sounded as if it were about to crack. I knew immediately that waking her mother was what she really wanted me to do, even if she couldn't say it. She needed to talk to her mother, to hear her soothing, reassuring voice on the other end of the phone. So wake Carrie, I did. She sprang out of bed and went outside with the phone. For about an hour, she sat on an old log in the lengthening shadows of tall pine trees, quietly talking with her daughter. A 10-year-old missing her mother, perhaps fearful that she might one day be gone for more than a long weekend. I don't know what they talked about, maybe nothing, maybe everything, but I know how important that call was to both of them. When I returned home from that weekend, I phoned my own mother. I don't remember what we talked about, but it sure felt good to hear her voice. My two daughters are now old enough for our phone conversations, and I cherish each and every one of them, even when they are about nothing important at all. And those articles and those wonderful testimonials were from This I Believe, Inc., which is an independent, not-for-profit, that encourages youth and adults to write and share essays on the core values that guide their lives. And I hope you enjoyed hearing those stories as much as I enjoyed reading them to you. And if you're a mom, I hope you had a wonderful Mother's Day weekend this past weekend. Now, from The Last Word to a brief article from the Health and Science section of The Week magazine for this week. And this one is entitled, America's Huge Sleep Deficit. Nearly one in three American workers is sleep-deprived, and the resulting epidemic of drowsiness is causing serious injuries and health problems. A new report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that more than 40 million workers in the U.S. get less than the minimum 6 hours of sleep per night that doctors recommend. If you hit the snooze button more than twice, you are probably sleep-deprived, psychologist and sleep expert Michael Bruce tells WebMD.com. Night shift workers, 44% of whom don't get enough rest, are the hardest hit, and they often hold jobs in transportation and health care. Two of the fields in which workers logged the least amount of shut-eye, lack of sleep had been linked to an increased risk of obesity, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. It can also impair attention and short-term memory, posing particularly dangerous problems for medical workers and those driving and operating heavy machinery. Researchers estimate that sleepiness causes 20% of traffic accidents and plays a role in thousands of fatal on-the-job mishaps each year. Now we'll turn to the talking point section here. Our article here is entitled Elizabeth Warren, A Little Bit Cherokee. Just call her Pocahontas, said Mark Stein in NationalReview.com. The already colorful Senate race in Massachusetts between Elizabeth Warren and Republican incumbent Scott Brown got a new jolt of life last week with the news that Warren has spent much of her adult life claiming to be a Native American. Warren, at most, is 1/32nd Cherokee, but she says her grandfather had high cheekbones, and that was evidently enough for this pale-faced liberal champion to list herself in a directory of minority law professors and for Harvard Law School to tout her employment as evidence of its diverse faculty. This knee-slapper raises some serious questions, said Michael Graham in the Boston Herald. Did Warren's self-promoting smoke signals lead Harvard Law to make her an affirmative action hire? When she came to the school, her resume was lacking the typical Ivy League credentials. The idea that Warren was unqualified is ridiculous on its face, said Joe Klein in Time.com. Warren became a brilliant and very popular professor at Harvard, one whose dazzling ability to elucidate the complexities of law and economics has made her a national consumer advocate and rising star in the Democratic Party. Admittedly, Warren's explanation for why she listed herself as Native Americans, the hope that it might help her meet people who are like I am, is silly. But a single check mark on a form from the 1990s should have absolutely no impact on this campaign. Warren identifying as Cherokee isn't ridiculous at all, said Sarah Burris in Politico.com. In Oklahoma, where both she and I were born, most folks have traces of Native American heritage, and we all grow up there hearing about which tribe or tribes we belong to. Indeed, the current chief of the Cherokee tribe is himself only 1/32nd Cherokee. Still, this flap will hurt Warren, said Steve Kornacki in Salon.com. Scott Brown's best chance of beating Warren in historically Democratic Massachusetts is to maximize the cultural distance between the Ivy League professor and the state's blue-collar voters, who react very negatively to even the merest whiff of affirmative action. As well they should, said Michael Barone in RealClearPolitics.com. Is there a better illustration of the absurdity of racial preferences than the idea that the blonde, blue-eyed Elizabeth Warren suffered some terrible disadvantage because of her undetectable Cherokee heritage? It's laugh-out-loud funny, but less so if you've been turned down for a job because you're white. The next article from the Talking Point section is entitled The Scream, Worth $120 Million? If someone gave you $121 million, said Holland Cotter in the New York Times, would you spend it on The Scream? Me neither. But last week, that astounding sum, the highest ever paid for an artwork at auction, is what an unknown bidder paid to own one of the best-known images in the world. The 1895 painting, one of four versions painted by Norwegian artist Edvard Munch, is a haunting image of a man's shrieking with existential dread against a blood-red sunset. The winning bid, enough money to fill a small museum with truly great art, was proof that whatever shape the economy is in, there's no limit to private cash, and art is a place where people like to park it. Call it art if you like, said A.N. Wilson in the Daily Mail. I call it a rather silly, badly executed cartoon. So why is The Scream worth so much money? Assigning a monetary value to a painting is inherently arbitrary, said Jerry Saltz in NYMag.com. But The Scream is a true work of art, a prophetic taste of expressionism on the cusp of the 20th century in which the sky itself glows with evil portent. The central figure is trapped between worlds, and alienation blazes. Oh, come now, said Felix Salmon in Reuters.com. The Scream's price is wholly the product of the fact that it's a cultural icon, appropriated by everyone from Andy Warhol to The Simpsons, and immortalized on millions of mugs, T-shirts, and refrigerator magnets. What this unknown buyer paid for wasn't art, but the result of a century's worth of marketing and hype. And now a couple of short articles as we reach the end of the program here. About 57% of girls in the U.S. between 15 and 19 have not had sexual intercourse, according to a new report by the Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention. That's up from 49% of teenage girls who said they were virgins in 1995. Propelled by a huge influx of spending by super PACs, 70% of the political ads aired so far in the 2012 race have been negative, defined as criticizing an opponent by name. In 2008, the share of negative ads at this point was 9.1%. The rate of myopia, short-sightedness, among school children in Japan, China, and other Asian nations has soared from 20% to more than 80% over the past generation, according to a new study in The Lancet. Researchers said the extraordinary rise in eye problems was caused by students spending many hours a day in class and at home studying and virtually no time in natural sunlight. And the number of Mormons in the U.S. grew by 45% to 6.1 million between 2000 and 2010, according to a new study by the Association of Religion Data Archives. The census found that the number of Catholics, the largest single faith, declined 5% to 58.9 million during that same decade. And we'll look at our poll watch as we close this week. Americans' personal financial comfort is at its lowest level since Gallup began measuring it a decade ago. 39% of Americans say they do not have enough money to live comfortably, up from 34% last year and 24% in 2002. And 45% of likely voters say President Obama's over-politicized the recent anniversary of Osama bin Laden's death, while 46% say his approach was just about right. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. I certainly hope you enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.